coming up on the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast.
Eventually, when I slowly started to meet other people, I discovered, oh, wow, a lot of us in these 12-step circles or non-12-step recovery circles have been going through this internal negotiation among themselves of, well, you know, my psychedelic trips were really never like my relationship with alcohol or cocaine or even maybe cannabis, for example. But we all share a level of apprehension of bringing this to our fellows in the 12-step rooms or our sponsors. And we certainly would probably experience alienation if we ever shared about it and stigmatized of that's a path to relapse. So we want to kind of bridge the harm reduction world of open, compassionate space for somebody to facilitate their own program of healing with the 12-step kind of welcoming model of we're here for you if you need us. So we established a set of guiding principles that essentially allows people to define their own program of sobriety.
Welcome to the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast, a weekly conversation series with leaders in psychedelic culture, designed for therapists, healers, retreat leaders, and passionate enthusiasts, presented by Maya and hosted by me, Eamon Armstrong. Welcome to the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. Today I'm speaking to Kevin Franciotti, founder of Psychedelics in Recovery, a fellowship of individuals in 12-step programs who wish to use psychedelics and plant medicines as part of their recovery. A passionate enthusiast of psychedelic medicine, Kevin's work is informed by his own relationship to addiction. On the show, we discuss Kevin's experience using Ibogaine as a treatment for his own opiate addiction and how his work in recovery has led to leadership. We talk about the history of Alcoholics Anonymous and other 12-step programs. We explore recovery with a harm reduction ethos, and finally, how psychedelic therapists can collaborate with the recovery community. Kevin is a journalist, a psychedelic researcher, a harm reduction educator, and a substance use recovery advocate. I think you'll enjoy this heartfelt account of Kevin's experience of addiction and recovery. All right. Well, here we go. I'm here in San Francisco, California, speaking to Kevin Franciotti out in New York City. How are you feeling today?
I am feeling sleep deprived, but still grounded amidst a lot of chaos right now. So it's good to be here with you.
Yeah, we're recording on March 26th, so there's a lot of chaos in the New York area right now. This won't be released until next month, so we'll be in a very different landscape. But today we are not speaking of any current crises. We're actually speaking of a pretty old organization, Alcoholics Anonymous, the 12-step program, and an even older healing modality, which is plant medicine and psychedelic therapy. And for many people, those two things would seem diametrically opposed. You know, when I think of a 12-step program, my understanding and sort of the cultural milieu is that this is a stridently abstinence-only perspective for which psychedelic therapies would be considered absolutely not allowed and potentially triggering a relapse. And then on the plant medicine side, there's this idea that, you know, this is a sort of mainstream, older approach to healing the 12-step program, and that it is too rigid and that it is not palatable from the side of shamanism or plant medicine healing. And yet, here we are with you yourself are in recovery and are using psychedelics as part of that recovery. In fact, explicitly in your work with Ibogaine treatment, and you are now advocating for psychedelics in recovery. So this is a really exciting conversation for me personally, and also for any psychedelic therapist whose clients may be in recovery or may be attempting to get into recovery for substance abuse issues. So I'm really thrilled to have you here. Thanks so much for taking the time to talk to me.
Yeah, thanks so much for having me on. It's a fascinating and deeply rich topic that can, based on your intro, can go off in a number of different directions, both with my personal story, some of the history of the things that you pointed out. So I guess I'll start with where you began with your summary. Alcoholics Anonymous was started in the late 1930s by a New York-based stockbroker and an Ohio physician, Bill W. being the former and Dr. Bob being the latter. And they were both incredibly problematic drinkers that were prior, had prior affiliation with a more religious-oriented recovery group called the Oxford Group. And neither were able to find success through that program. They found it a little bit too rigidly dogmatic in a kind of Judeo-Christian framework, and the emphasis on kind of a moralistic approach to atoning sinful type behavior didn't really resonate with somebody who may have had tons of moralistic problems, but couldn't really piece together how that could help him stop drinking. So Bill W., in the late 1930s, kind of just discovered this peer-to-peer model of one alcoholic helping another. And through his personal journey, met this guy, Dr. Bob, and through their work together, just started helping out alcoholics peer-to-peer. And they took some of the lessons, the spiritual themes that they learned from the Oxford group, and kind of repackaged them in a more agnostic kind of DIY approach to spirituality. And they wanted to keep the component of a spiritually based recovery from alcoholism, but they also didn't want to have a lot of the attachments towards religious upbringing that people might be turned off by. So that's kind of, and in the, I'm sure you can imagine, in like the earlier portion of the 20th century, shortly before the 1950s and big boom of post-World War II era Americana, even just distancing yourself from a Protestant kind of affiliation is controversial in and of itself. But the desperation of alcoholics in those days was such that they felt kind of not necessarily neglected or abandoned, but insufficiently treated by the mainstream medical community. So they were looking for these things outside of institutions, outside of hospitals, that really just didn't know what to do with severe problematic drinkers. So they adopted this approach of having a spiritual awakening as a result of working a 12-step process that begins with admitting powerlessness of one's ability to stop drinking on one's own. And the whole basis of the 12-step program is designed to admit that powerlessness so that one can work the rest of the steps and achieve a new power that previously hadn't been available to them, but was always accessible if they were able to put down the drink. So in that context, it was a very early, exciting time for changing the mainstream conversation about alcoholism and later other types of substance use issues among the general public. And because of that, there was a big effort to have the medical community recognize alcoholism as a disease, petition insurance providers to recognize the need to fund services and provide really an allopathic model of alcoholism. At that point, by the 1950s, several years into AA, AA had become established, groups had been flourishing around the country, and soon enough starting to be around the world. Bill Wilson himself continued to struggle with other psychological issues after successfully being able to maintain abstinence for a number of years. He struggled immensely with depression, and despite efforts to get psychotherapy and outside professional help in addition to AA, he never really was able to get relief from some chronic symptoms of depression. And at the time, for those familiar with the psychedelic history of research in the 1950s and early 1960s, one of the biggest avenues of research was LSD or psilocybin for the treatment of alcoholism. And while there were Canadian psychiatrists and people on the West Coast familiar with working with alcoholics and LSD to help them stop drinking, they were also exploring different applications for psychedelics, including things like depression and anxiety. So Bill Wilson contacted a psychiatrist in Canada to receive LSD treatment for his depression. So he was already firmly established in sobriety, and AA was already firmly established in its like original framework. But the experience that Bill Wilson had during this treatment for him reinvigorated all of the spiritual teachings that he and Dr. Bob brought into the 12 steps. And he imagined the LSD, the psychedelic experience, as offering a potential breakthrough opportunity for alcoholics struggling to grasp the spiritual nature of recovery. And he viewed it as what could possibly be a crucial introduction to what a spiritual, like a preview for what a spiritual awakening could be after successfully working through the rest of the 12 steps. So he wanted in the very beginning, after his experience, to bring this experience to other alcoholics. AA had a bit of a problem with that. And from that point, despite kind of petitioning the larger fellowship, they opted to not embrace LSD treatment. And then, you know, history speaks for itself with how the mainstream society reacted to psychedelics in the 60s.
It's really interesting what is distilled through kind of the cultural milieu about it. So I was aware that Bill W. had used LSD. I wasn't aware that it had happened so long after he had started Alcoholics Anonymous. So it was like 20 years afterwards that he'd used it, and that he was using it for persistent chronic psychological problems that hadn't been resolved simply by his sobriety. And that's a really valuable thing to kind of pin there, because I think when I think about recovery, there's a real binary of, you know, you have the problem, which is your addiction. And when you're able to recover from that addiction, then that problem is removed. Whereas what I've understood in my relationship to addiction, my own experiences around compulsive behavior and just trauma generally, is that these are symptoms, that the addiction is a symptom. And that if you're able to come into recovery by maintaining sobriety, that doesn't necessarily mean that you have resolved underlying depression, trauma, wounds that then need to be healed over time.
Yeah, and that's a large part of the reason why AA and the 12-step model doesn't work for a lot of people, because the nature of interrupting an active addiction, the active cycle of obsessive compulsive use, despite increasing negative consequences, can be very challenging for people with such extensive trauma backgrounds or other underlying mental health conditions. So imagine telling somebody that their behavior that may have very well been a quasi-successful self-medication approach, despite a lot of other problems it caused in their life, did provide relief. So you're going to tell people that they now have to stop that and get sober, get clean, go through detox, and experience life completely raw and anew, and then seek recovery from your mental health conditions. That sort of style doesn't work for a lot of people. And the kind of black and white approach to abstinence just doesn't resonate with a tremendous amount of people. And to kind of go back to where you were starting off with talking about the psychedelic community's take on 12 steps as being an antiquated approach, that criticism is very sound. And a lot of the rigidity and dogma of 12-step groups and their approach to abstinence has maintained that way. And they haven't really evolved. And if you look at some of the early material from it, even the language is very antiquated and lacking like sophisticated updates to more modern colloquialisms and gender mentioning and the emphasis on God. So despite this recognition of trying to keep an open-minded approach towards spirituality, many, many people still to this day find it very closed-minded and difficult to access. So in the decades since AA first began, there have been a number of additional 12-step fellowships that have kind of offshot from it, the first being Narcotics Anonymous in the 50s, when drug addicts were heavily stigmatized and basically marginalized out of the rooms, both in the rooms of AA, both for internal reasons within the AA program as being a program for drinkers and not drug addicts, but also because of the criminal justice system. There were the Rockefeller drug laws that actually made it illegal for more than one known drug addict to congregate with another because they must be doing drug-related behavior or conspiracies. So just meeting, just having a Narcotics Anonymous meeting was actually illegal. And in the very early days, when a heroin addict would come into an AA meeting, they would either not be welcomed, or for those that were coming around to the idea that other people struggle with other substances besides alcohol and the 12-step approach could work, would kind of point them to this other room for the drug addicts to go and have their meeting. But it took a long time for even Narcotics Anonymous to be established and drug addiction recovery to be welcomed in this approach as well. So decades later, you touched on kind of behavioral compulsions, and there's all now it's commonly known as lots of different types of behavioral addictions, like gambling. Even eating disorders are looked at through an obsessive compulsive lens. There's sex addiction. So each of these kind of perspectives on addiction has almost all of them have led to their own 12-step group. There are probably over a dozen 12-step groups for different types of substance use or behavioral addictions. And what we've been doing with the group that we're calling Psychedelics in Recovery is using all of the lessons learned from that entire decades-long history and all of the organizational and philosophical and ideological evolving that has gone on to kind of package it all under our umbrella 12-step group for people who identify as being in recovery from any substance or behavioral addiction and are interested in incorporating the use of psychedelics and integrating it into their ongoing recovery.
What I'd like to do to bridge these two worlds is go through the lens of your own experience. In my understanding, as you were going through your own struggles with addiction, you were introduced to the 12-step model and rejected it and found that it wasn't for you. And you ultimately found a lot of recovery and release through a very potent psychedelic, ibogaine. I'm interested in the story of that trajectory, and especially what then, after using ibogaine for recovery, brought you back to the 12-step program. And as a way of creating a bridge between these two approaches to healing, I'd like to look at it through the lens of your own story.
And I mean, that's a perfect place to kind of bridge those two worlds, because if it weren't for my personal story, I don't think I would have ever oriented back towards this and try to bring it all together. So briefly, my background and interest in drugs and psychedelics started as a teenager and discovering my experimental use and becoming fascinated with these non-ordinary states of consciousness. And growing up without any kind of harm reduction based drug education or inquiring towards these states, everything that I did was in a more rebellious counterculture kind of mentality. And I idolized people like Jim Morrison and the hippie generation.
When were you born?
In 86.
Okay, yeah. So we're around the same age, and I had a similar adolescence where the psychedelic realms were the coolest of the cool. And I recall my own fetishization of all of these different psychedelic motifs at that time.
Yeah. So I was completely ignorant up until this age of there being such a rich history and such a nuanced perspective on having relationships with drugs that aren't necessarily positive or negative. They can be both. They're not mutually exclusive. But in my discovering of these states, it was all in this kind of rebellious vein. So anything that I discovered was all of my own accord, and just doing internet research and discovering the history and then discovering organizations like MAPS or Arrowhead to learn more like true drug education resources that I had never been exposed to outside of DARE. So it was very self-directed, and I became basically obsessed. And by the end of high school and starting college, I was under the impression that I'd be dedicating my life to becoming a psychedelic researcher. At the same time, my own kind of journey towards becoming someone with a significant substance use disorder was just constantly brimming under the surface. And I would get arrested for marijuana possession in large quantities. And whenever that would happen, I would get confronted with the question of, are you doing the right thing or not? And I would always avoid that and say, well, my life isn't spiraling out of control yet. And addiction never entered the realm of my thinking. It was just a problem with behavior or being in the wrong place at the wrong time. So as those kind of years progressed and towards college, I continued to struggle with emotional development and my relationships. And eventually I my experimentation led towards opiates. And ironically, I had been somewhat successful in my college career at putting things in place to become a psychedelic researcher. I had an internship at Harvard watching the MDMA for cancer anxiety phase two clinical trial happening. I helped start an SSDP chapter to host an Ibogaine conference.
What is SSDP?
Students for Sensible Drug Policy, a national drug reform organization. And I was trying to basically start that chapter at Northeastern in Boston in order to sponsor this Ibogaine conference in 2009. And Ibogaine had been this elusive, exotic drug that I first discovered on the Arrowhead homepage. And always as something like, whoa, that's too far out. I don't think I'll ever be directly exposed to that. But I was aware of it from a pretty early time in my own journey. But ironically, after the 2009 conference, I fell into a relationship with opiates that would quickly become pretty destructive within a year. I graduated from illicit prescription painkiller use to injecting heroin, all in the span of about a year. And as a result of that, external measures prevented me from continuing too far in that realm. And I got arrested one night. The cat was out of the bag with how severe my drug use had been. And not having any interest still in confronting my own behavior, the only motivation I had to go to rehab and become exposed to addiction recovery was I was now facing a felony charge. And my attorney mentioned that the only way he'd be able to help my case is to go to rehab, build up a documented history of being someone who has an addiction and is seeking help from it, so that by the time the court really looks at my case, they can say, hey, he's been seeking treatment. So in this rehab program in 2010, I was exposed to the 12-step framework for recovery and wanted nothing to do with it. I'm not a drug addict. I'm not an alcoholic. I don't really care about these spiritual approaches to recovery. And I have no interest in stopping using drugs. So I'll stay here in this program for a month to give my lawyer some good ammunition to use in my case, but I'm not moving into a halfway house. I'm not like continuing outpatient programs afterwards, and I'm not going to meetings when I leave. So coming out of rehab with that mentality, I quickly just fell back into the patterns of behavior that I was doing right before I got in, and continued using in a pretty severe way for another 9 to 10 months, until a like very compassionate, intimate intervention by my mother in a loving way just asked me if I needed help. Didn't you know, threaten to cut me off or kick me out of the house. It was just a, hey, you haven't left your room in 3 days. Like, do you need help? And I said, yes, I don't really want to go back to rehab. I think I want to try this Ibogaine substance that I've known about for a number of years, and I think it could help me. So in 2011, I went to Mexico. I met a treatment provider who was in affiliation with MAPS. They were running the Ibogaine observational trial, and suddenly my years of not having any opportunity to participate in psychedelic research had a very ironic kind of opportunity in front of me as being able to provide good data as a participant. So I suddenly had internal motivation for recovery, whereas before all I had was other people telling me that I need to stay clean.
Who was the researcher that you worked with in Mexico?
The researcher was Tom Kingsley Brown. He was out of San Diego, and he was recruiting participants out of this clinic in Mexico. So I met after I got picked up off the plane in San Diego by the head of the clinic. We stopped by, you know, Whole Foods or something, and met with Kingsley, who gave us a lot of the paperwork. And I met him, and then we drove down into Mexico to go to the clinic. And I was enrolled in the study. I had, you know, enough of experience with like the research procedures that I was kind of just geeking out in an academic way. So it was a weird kind of cognitive dissonance between being a patient and then also like, oh, cool, I'm a researcher now too, kind of. Very, very strange kind of experience for me. But I was now in a race against time in terms of my last use before I got on that plane out of New York. And I remember like sitting in my bedroom at 2 a.m. trying to time, like, when can I last shoot up? Because I don't know what's going to happen in Mexico. I don't know if I'm going to get picked up at the airport in San Diego. I don't really know. It was just this fear of the unknown, and I had to make a leap of faith, but I still had 2 more bags. So I'm like, should I bring them with me? Should I go through security? Should I shoot up on the plane? What can I do to ensure like the longest possible time of going before I would be in full-blown withdrawal? And I was at such a broken extreme point in my use that even like logically trying to plan this out ended up being, okay, I'm going to shoot up 5 minutes from now. I didn't wait at all. And probably that saved me a potential ordeal going through security. So it's probably for the best that I didn't bring that stuff with me to the airport. But nevertheless, like I got on this plane having nothing with me, knowing nobody, and just trusting that this process would unfold. So by the time I reached the clinic, I wasn't really panicked. I wasn't really anxious. Really, I wanted to approach the Ibogaine experience openly and vulnerably. And for the first time, despite having dozens of psychedelic experiences under my belt beforehand, I don't think I had ever really approached them with the respect and reverence that I was about to embark on, given the fact that I was now in an incredibly broken place and seeking like medicinal healing.
That's an important distinction, I think, when we're talking about psychedelic therapy in the context of recovery versus the sort of polydrug approach of addiction where you're combining all sorts of substances and maybe you're taking a little acid and, you know, taking psychedelics in a capacity that isn't the proper set and setting for therapeutic healing. I think that this might also be something that is part of the stigma for people in recovery around the power of psychedelics. They may have, as you had, taken psychedelics during their period of addiction and use and associated that. And for you, when you hadn't done any kind of ceremonial experience with psychedelics, correct, or any type of therapeutic, it was all just kind of recreational use of psilocybin or LSD?
Yeah, I had never... I would say that I never tripped with anybody who really knew what they were doing. I'll put it that way. In a ceremonial context, in a healing modality context, it was purely part of like the drug culture as I learned to understand it. Even when I was maybe in circles with professionals or academics, it never really took on a flavor of being the right kind of respect or context for the experience itself. But I something just came up that I do want to speak to, in that these experiences can be so powerful for people that quote recreational contexts don't mean that people can't experience healing. And I'm sure you agree with that. And many people who have gone to festivals or raves or parties or really just spending a weekend in the woods with some friends, those contexts can provide profound healing. And even in the story with the case of Ibogaine, the way that was discovered in the West, a Western civilization, by a person with a pretty severe heroin addiction and named Howard Lotsoff in Staten Island, New York, he was, you know, living a very drug-addled lifestyle in New York City. And a chemist friend of his just said, hey, I think you'd like this stuff. Just try it. And he took Ibogaine in 1962, I believe it was, and came out of the experience a few days later as he walked up his front steps, having done his last shot of heroin a few days before. The way he had retold his epiphany moment is that every other time he walked up the front steps of his house, the first thought that would pop into his mind is, when am I going to get my next fix? This time, coming out of his Ibogaine experience, walked up his front steps, realizing, I haven't shot dope in 3 days and I don't feel sick. What's going on here? So it can catch someone off guard in that way, given how powerful these healing states could be. So the reason I chose Ibogaine is because I knew about its potential for healing opiate dependency and opiate addiction.
an Ibogaine isn't simply a profound spiritual experience that makes you realize that you no longer want to use heroin. It actually does bind to opioid receptors in the brain in a way that is extremely efficacious for surmounting the withdrawal of heroin and for actually changing your body's chemical dependency. Is that's accurate?
Exactly. Yeah, it has certain psychedelics have in animal models shown some kind of triggering of growth factors in different regions of the brain that may or may not be helpful to recovery from addiction, but none quite as comprehensive and all-encompassing as Ibogaine does. And especially for something like opiate dependence, Ibogaine provides a treatment for the withdrawal syndrome associated with that in a way that's unlike drugs like methadone or buprenorphine that are what they're called pro-opioid agonists. So they are basically activating the exact same receptor system, but without the kind of euphoric high that morphine or heroin or other opium derivatives would cause. So my experience with it, and others attest to this as well, it is kind of miraculous, the physical state that Ibogaine brings up in somebody who is withdrawing from opiates. I was waiting for the medicine to kick in, knowing that the clock was running out on my peak withdrawal phase. And by the time the medicine took effect, I was instantaneously relieved of any of the fear that I would normally associate with kicking cold turkey. And I recognized immediately that there was something incredibly powerful working in me that, oddly enough, allowed me to still be somewhat aware of the physical symptoms of withdrawal, but relieved and comforted and feeling euphoric enough to not care. And it was sort of like having the flu, but being able to attach from those symptoms and know that this is something that my body is experiencing, but I'm not. And I'm going to get through this experience. And it is really miraculous. It's kind of the only word I can think about it now, looking back on this experience years later, so quickly how this relief washed over me and was absolutely incredible.
I'm not sure if you are aware, but I've taken Iboga myself, not for opiate addiction, but for spiritual experimentation and discovery. And I recall the feeling afterwards, that kind of newborn puppy feeling where there's just no stress or trauma in your body at all. As you were describing the relief you felt that the withdrawal symptoms weren't present, that was such a contrast to my experience of Iboga, because I wasn't anticipating withdrawal symptoms, and the actual physical and psychological experience of the Iboga was extremely challenging. So I didn't go from, oh my God, withdraw, wow, I'm so happy the withdrawal's not here. I went from, oh, I wonder what this is going to be like, to being like, oh, this is super crazy and hard. So it's interesting how, you know, these different medicines show up in our lives in different ways and allow us to experience different kinds of healings that we need. And for me, psycho-spiritually, I felt a deep and profound healing in my Iboga experience, but it wasn't, it didn't have to do with a dependency that was then being neurologically rewired. It had more to do with sort of deeper trauma. But it's fascinating how these medicines are so powerful at healing us on multiple levels.
Yeah, and thank you for sharing that experience. I do hear, you know, people having tremendously challenging experiences, and that is often associated with the Iboga or Ibogaine experience. And I feel very grateful for not necessarily having such a challenging ride, though being in the state while coming down from the peak effects. So I kind of have this, I had this impression coming down off of it that I was sort of like on a roller coaster ride throughout the peak effects of it during the night, that I was really, really feeling the medicine working through me. And it was an overwhelmingly positive experience in a lot of ways, physical and psychological. It really sparked, like re-energized this spark in me that had remained like faintly dim, that was my like lust for life and my love for myself and the yearning to keep on living in a healthy way, was just kind of, ignited by ibogaine, and it was like throwing a little bit of gasoline on this spark and totally awakened my spirit. So I had this 7-8 hour roller coaster ride that, once those peak effects kind of started to dwindle, I now felt that I was paying the price of admission for that experience. And the entire next day was incredibly painful. And even though I wasn't being kind of confronted with images or flashes of memory, I was overwhelmed by emotions like shame and guilt and remorse. And the therapeutic quality to that was that I had nothing to do but face those feelings for an entire day. And I didn't even really have an opportunity to talk to too many people about it. And I don't know how helpful that even would have been. So I'm sure others might have struggled a lot with it if the pain was so unimaginable. But fortunately for me, it kind of solidified a commitment to wanting to recover and knowing that my journey had only just begun. Yeah. So just referring to it as the price of admission for the roller coaster ride the night before has been the best way for me to look at it.
I just want to kind of lend our minds here to the psychedelic therapist who is listening to this podcast now. The two questions are, how does a psychedelic therapist approach working with healing addiction? And how does a psychedelic therapist work with someone who is in a recovery program? And how is that? How does one communicate that? And so to approach those questions, I'd like to continue with your narrative about how you then found the 12-step program to be efficacious after your ibogaine experience.
Yeah, that's a great question to keep in mind. And I think that psychedelic therapists or therapists who are familiar with working with people with addictions have likely experienced for themselves the kinds of approaches that work better than others. So for my story, I kind of was dealing with both at the same time. In order to fulfill the arrangement that I had made with my parents to pay for my ibogaine treatment, I said to them that I would commit to living in a halfway house and getting any job that I could to start paying my rent and build my life up from scratch, essentially. So in order to do that, I moved to South Florida, which is kind of a recovery mecca of the US and especially in the 12-step style and many different treatment centers and halfway houses. And so to put it in context, as I mentioned earlier, I had a ton of external accountability measures, and then participating in the MAPS trial was like a serious internal motivator to show objective measurements of success. Obviously, my main internal motivator was to save my life and heal the damaged relationships and avoid spiraling back into self-destructive behaviors. So by the time I landed in South Florida, basically everything that I was committing to was because of those external accountability measures. So my felony case had been transferred to the New York Drug Treatment Court, and my lawyer had successfully petitioned the court to allow me to complete the program under their stipulations in Florida, as long as I attended, you know, 3 IOP intensive outpatient group sessions and individual counseling and regular monitoring of drug testing. So that was one system of accountability. The other system was just living in the halfway house, which required me to attend 100 12-step meetings in my first 100 days, get a job within the first 2 weeks to start paying rent, get a sponsor in that 12-step group and start working the steps, and get drug tested again for the stipulations of just maintaining in the house. The third accountability measure was the MAP study. Then there was kind of a fourth, which was a private therapist that I saw, mostly because many of the things that I was doing, I was kind of just going through the motions. I was going to meetings because I became more open-minded to them. I realized that they were a place to meet a lot of like-minded people seeking recovery from addiction. I may not agree with all the basic tenets of the program, but I'm certainly, if I'm going to have to go to 100 meetings in 100 days, I'm not going to sit in the back with my arms crossed resisting it the whole time. I'm going to enter into it with an open mind. And that was a helpful perspective to have later. The outpatient, I do not feel that I got much of any relief from. I would feel a bit more like kind of humiliated and shamed and stigmatized going into the program, and sort of felt like I was wasting my time because there were other things that I was doing that I was finding a lot more enriching. So your question about my experience working with like treatment modalities that were working and what weren't working, my private therapist was so much more like open and trusting and listening and not kind of coming at me with a prepackaged program of suggestions and advice. He wanted to just give me the space to express myself and allow me to help figure out for myself what would be the best approach moving forward. And I didn't really feel like I was encountering that in the outpatient group. I felt like here was a solution that you could either take it or leave it. And in some ways, that was even true in the 12-step meetings. But I soon learned that they are heavily malleable to personal adaptation and personal adoption of what works for me and what didn't. So I met a lot of great people. I was receiving a lot of good information. And eventually I just kind of got to a stabilization point where all of these accountability measures were just kind of happening. And I could live my life just doing them and finding joy and fulfillment wherever I could. The thing that I started to encounter, because of the fact that South Florida was such a recovery mecca, I had been so socially isolated prior to my Ibogaine experience that the only person I really talked to was my dealer. And by the time I got to South Florida, was heavily interested in reconnecting with other people, was surrounded by people in recovery all the time that I don't know. So in order to get to know one another, people would just ask you, hey, what was your drug of choice? Where are you from? What detox did you go to? Just like simple ways of starting a conversation. And every time I answered those questions, it would open up a can of worms of really a lot of uncomfortable responses to the fact that I was in Mexico and not a traditional detox. I took this exotic drug called Ibogaine and wasn't weaned down on a buprenorphine or on a methadone maintenance program. So a lot of the feedback that I would get was a little superficial, and I would commonly get this response of like, oh, I would love to have taken that myself, or I'd love to take that now. And yeah, I used to love tripping. And I just had this bad taste in my mouth from all of those conversations that it eventually led me to completely withdraw from sharing that experience with people, unless it was on a more personal level. So I started to kind of have an internalized shame about the fact that I had such a different story of entering into abstinence than everybody else did. And I felt kind of handcuffed to even sharing about it when I celebrated my like 6 month or 9 month anniversaries, and people would often kind of shout like, oh, how'd you do it? I kind of had to skip over what for me was a incredibly vital and transformative experience that I don't think would have put me on a recovery path had I not had it. So it was pretty painful to be so quieted like that. It was in short supply the space that I did have to talk about that. So my private therapist, again, was very like open to processing this with me. And I kind of gave him an on the fly training of being an integration coach, even though he had like no experience really with somebody, a client of his who had a psychedelic healing that really was separate from all of his kind of drug seeking behavior and self-destructive addiction pattern prior to that. But at one point, we had an interesting situation when a few months later, you know, I was like, I would love to trip again without having to be kicking. I would love to be in that Ibogaine state, being able to explore like the inner recesses of my psyche without having to worry about the fact that I was coming off dope. And I had to process this with him, and it created a very interesting confrontation between the 12-step approach of kind of mandating abstinence overall as being required to count your sober time or your clean time, which kind of sets up this hierarchy in the rooms in that you need X amount of days in order to chair a meeting or be the group secretary or treasurer. and you need X amount of years to be a sponsor or something like that. So it sets up this kind of little hierarchy going on. But when I brought this intention to my therapist, we had to just kind of sit down and process, is this relapse behavior talking? Is this a setup to take you off of your recovery path? Or is this something that is going to become crucial for you? And what we ended up kind of agreeing on was, you know, I haven't really tried to commit to the 12 steps yet. I have kind of explored the first three in understanding my powerlessness over an inability to, of my own free will, to stop using substances. I kind of am getting the sense of the step two and the step three, which are, we came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity. And we made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of a higher power as we see that higher power. So those two steps I was still kind of struggling with a little bit, because they're basically asking you to agree that you believe that the 12-step program is the solution for you, and that you're going to bring all of your struggles to this group so that you can heal from them. And I was more of the opinion like, well, I'll get to that stuff eventually, but I kind of just want to feel better right now. And because that was where we were getting at, it occurred to me that maybe I should try this 12-step approach out more fully. Maybe I should commit to a full cycle through the steps and maybe a full year of total abstinence before I consider doing anything else. And that proved to be an incredibly effective approach that would serve for later epiphanies when I rediscovered a place for psychedelics in the 12 steps.
And now you are advocating a psychedelic component to recovery programs. And it sounds like you had to go through your own process of finding the appropriate place for the 12-step program and for your own relationship to psychedelic medicine and healing. How are you sharing that with others now? Are you encouraging others to take a path that you took? Are you hosting meetings that are advocating for the use of psychedelics in recovery? How are you taking what you've learned and using it to support others?
So we tried to honor the spirit of all 12-step groups as being very open to members that consider themselves to identify with the program and the platform of it. So I don't, and I have never set up psychedelics in recovery or those of us who help guide the framework of the program. We don't suggest that anybody really do anything that they're not already entertaining for themselves. What was fascinating for me in the years since my initial time of entering recovery, discovering a place for psychedelics and discovering the complementary approach to seeking ongoing healing and relief, is I was not alone in this journey. Eventually, when I slowly started to meet other people, I discovered, oh wow, a lot of us in these 12-step circles or non-12-step recovery circles have been going through this internal negotiation among themselves of, well, you know, my psychedelic trips were really never like my relationship with alcohol or cocaine or even maybe cannabis, for example. But we all share a level of apprehension of bringing this to our fellows in the 12-step rooms or our sponsors. And we certainly would probably experience alienation if we ever shared about it, and stigmatized of that's a path to relapse. So we want to kind of blend or bridge the harm reduction world of open, compassionate space for somebody to facilitate their own program of healing with the 12-step kind of welcoming model of we're here for you if you need us. So we established a set of guiding principles that essentially allows people to define their own program of sobriety. And if sobriety or recovery or whatever word that they choose to use means that they're totally abstinent from their most severe relationships with drugs, whatever that may be, but they recognize that other relationships are not as problematic. And we took that precedent from another 12-step group that broke off from AA with a behavioral component to it, the Sex and Love Addicts Anonymous and some eating disorders fellowships. Obviously, those behaviors don't necessarily require or should require abstinence. You can't stop eating. You aren't necessarily going to devote yourself to a life of celibacy if you are trying to recover from a sex addiction. So they have these built-in spectrums of behaviors that are kind of what they call bottom lines, stuff I won't do, and other areas that are less problematic but are helpful to just kind of be cautious of them. So what we've been having now in our online meetings, since 2017, we've decided to meet twice a week or twice a month on Zoom. And lately, we've now actually bumped it up to once every week, given the shift towards online meetings with the COVID-19 crisis. So we have a space for, over the years of growing our fellowship, we have amassed a list in our Google group of close to 250 members. We've now decided to set up a private Facebook group where people can try to fellowship and communicate and network off in between these meetings. We're building a Slack channel to provide that opportunity as well. And we're starting to experience some somewhat exponential growth in what we haven't had in the first couple of years, which our Zoom meeting last week had about 30 people signing on, whereas our meetings are usually about a dozen. And we're having another meeting tonight, our first in this new monthly regimen of online meetings. So it'll be interesting to see how many people tune into this. But what we're now starting to do is really grow and expand beyond just our membership and broaden our literature and our kind of resources available to people to learn more about it. And the most exciting aspect of this is a new foundation has formed to support recovery communities that are utilizing psychedelics. So our group, Psychedelics in Recovery, among a couple of other communities, one in the San Francisco Bay Area, one in upstate New York, and there's a couple of others, are now collaborating with an advisory board of people who have tremendous experience and offerings to these communities to help kind of guide us in shaping our programs more broadly. And we have the backing, the financial backing, but more importantly, the expertise to collaborate over this for the next year or so. So it's a really, really exciting time given everything that's going on.
Are there psychedelic therapists who are part of this group? Are you connected with folks who are practicing psychedelic therapy with patients who are in recovery?
Yes. Yeah. We have treatment providers, we have anthropological researchers and others that are kind of experts at community peer-to-peer support groups. And we have like trained psychiatrists and it's a very well-rounded group of experts with tremendous amounts of experience. And their intentions are to, again, kind of echoing back to my personal journey, their intentions are to help us by listening first and then offering tools and resources and suggestions that are directly relevant to what we're already doing to help maybe brainstorm beyond those things and not just come in and tell us, oh, no, this is the protocol that you should be following, or we would never suggest you doing that. It's a much more conversational style that's providing a lot more fruitful collaboration.
And what advice would you give with everything that you've learned? What advice would you give to a psychedelic therapist who wants to work with someone who's in recovery, and especially someone who may be working in a 12-step program to help that client understand whether and how psychedelic therapy would be valuable for them?
I think the number one take-home thing to express to someone like that is that they are far from being alone or unique in that intention, and they shouldn't be kind of judged or made to feel like they're putting their recovery in jeopardy first and foremost. And I think that like the one of the overarching tenets of harm reduction is to meet people where they're at and to provide the best quality education and resources for people so that whatever they choose to do, they can approach it in the safest and least less riskful way as possible. So just establishing this trusting collaboration and being a peer-to-peer insider with them in their work and figuring this out, and that there are people like them. That the second thing I would probably advise against is just being too much of a, be cautious about going back to one's inner recovery circle and their established relationships with people in their groups or their peers, and just be mindful of who you're sharing this with so that you don't get a response that, you know, feels alienating or stigmatizing. But we don't recommend that people keep it a secret. So we want to allow people the opportunity to figure this out for themselves. But our members have had a lot of experiences that are both favorable. Some have gone to their groups because they recognize, though, my group is pretty open, I think they'll be solid and support me with this. And that's exactly what they found. But we've had others who have decided to share this with people that have kind of shunned them entirely. So we've seen a mix.
Does your organization collect any data on this, or are you familiar with any groups that have any kind of measurement around the efficacy of psychedelics in the context of recovery? Is there any way to get a kind of a quantitative look at how this whole approach is working?
We are exploring that with this Project New Day collaboration. And for now, we have been so focused on just establishing ourselves and our program in order to attract members to find us that we haven't necessarily approached that just yet. But like anecdotally, what we've typically found was that our program right now works best as a supplemental opportunity for people that have kind of firmly established footings in more traditional 12-step groups who then seek a psychedelic experience to find us, rather than somebody who's struggling to end their addictive relationship with heroin or alcohol by using psychedelics and then working the 12 steps. We're certainly heading in the direction where we want to recognize those needs for different types of people, but the way we've built our program for now attracts more people with what I would say kind of an already stable approach to their recovery.
And are you encouraging, I understand that the Alcoholics Anonymous model is anonymous in its very name, and it's really a space for people who are going through that experience. In what you've been creating, is there space for psychedelic therapists who are interested in offering better support for their clients? Is there space for them to be part of this community to collaborate with you? Or is this more of a private space for people who are going through the recovery program themselves?
So that's a great question. We 12-step meetings have what they call closed and open meetings. Closed meetings are for those who identify as being a person in recovery. Open meetings are open to anybody. And so our group is obviously very small. We have really just our one online group. We have an in-person meeting in San Diego and another one in Seattle, and we're hoping to keep that growing. So our intention is to support people that eventually will open up in-person meetings. So groups can decide amongst themselves who is welcome and whether they want it to be an open or a closed meeting. So far, our online meeting has been predominantly a closed meeting, but it's very easy to just get a group consensus prior to that meeting of hey, there's a psychotherapist or a psychiatrist who works with people with addiction that wants to check us out. Are people okay with that person participating and observing? And that's actually something that we are doing with Project New Day. We're having, you know, kind of formalized observations by some of the members of the advisory board who are going to write up a very like succinct description of based on their expertise, what they observed. So the answer is we're welcome to it. And there may be some groups that are kind of open to it and others that may say like, oh, well, thank you for your interest. We're happy to talk to you outside of a meeting, but we would rather keep the space for people that identify themselves.
And in your leadership role here, are you welcome to psychedelic therapists reaching out to you directly to get a better understanding about how to support clients of theirs that are in recovery? Are you an available resource for people to connect with? And if so, how might people reach out to you?
Absolutely. Yeah, that's, I mean, one of the biggest reasons I've come on shows like this, and thank you again for inviting me on, is to provide that reference for people. So I can be emailed directly at franciotti.k@gmail.com. I maintain a relatively active social media life on Twitter at Kevin Franciotti. I have a website that is mostly my published writing on topics like psychedelic healing at kevin.franciotti.net.
And you were writing for Vice. I think that's how you and I first met. Yeah.
Yes. Yeah. I freelanced for a number of years and I've had a couple assignments in Vice.
Nice. Well, thank you so much, Kevin, for sharing your personal story and giving a different lens of a population that totally can benefit from this kind of therapy and support and offering a nuanced view. And I really appreciate you offering it through the lens of your own life, because it's so much more palatable to understand these things, these concepts, when they're not simply abstract, but actually you can see them through someone's successful recovery. And it's beautiful to see how you've taken your own recovery and turned it into a gift that you're offering other people. So, you know, I really see that and really honor that as a beautiful way of blossoming your own healing into service.
Thank you so much for saying that. Yeah. And this intention has attracted the right types of people. And I have to thank those that I will keep nameless in our group that have been offering the same level of service, because it's very, very clear when you talk to any of us that we're not out here to market anything. We're not out here to try to get rich off of some repackaged idea. And we really also owe a tremendous amount of gratitude to, like, the founders of these fellowships and the dedicated lives that have really sought through time that they've volunteered basically to bring healing to those that are still sick and suffering. Mm.
And as our final moment on the show today, is there anything that you'd like to say directly to someone who is working as a psychedelic therapist or plans to work as a psychedelic therapist in supporting the healing of people around the world? Is there anything any message that you'd like to share directly to our listeners?
I would say that psychedelic therapists are probably the best equipped people to handle this type of client and this type of work, because in the field of addiction treatment, compassion is often in short supply. People can empathize, people can attempt to put to look at the client on the other side of the table as being someone who's willing of their time and energy, but it's rarer to find somebody who can compassionately emote in the same way and actually feel like a partner in this fight. And psychedelic therapists are the right types of people for that work.
Mm, beautiful. Well, Kevin, thank you so much for your time and for the good work you're doing in the world and for sharing it with us today. Really appreciate that.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Ina.
Thank you for joining us on the Psychedelic Therapy Podcast. If you enjoyed this show, please join the Psychedelic Therapy Facebook group to talk about it. You can also share it with your friends or leave a review on iTunes so more people can discover the show. The Psychedelic Therapy Podcast is presented by Maya, a platform designed to help psychedelic therapists manage and measure client journeys. You can head to mayahealth.com to learn more. The show is for informational purposes only and is not intended to provide mental health or medical advice. Thanks for listening.